Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading from the June-July 2025 issue of Guideposts with articles like Beyond My Control. Beyond My Control, Close Calls. The pilot's voice was completely calm, but his words terrified me. I need you all in crash position. By Jeannie Hughes, Hurricane, West Virginia. My co-workers and I dragged our luggage across the tarmac to the small company plane that would take us back to West Virginia. I felt exactly the way my red suitcase looked, battered and worn. Our trip out to Colorado had been the first time I'd ever flown, and although the flight had gone well, my nerves were still on edge. At least the conference had been a huge success. We had secured the order for our artificial lenses used in cataract surgeries. As I waited to board, I noticed a shiny penny lying heads up on the first step. "Hey, look, Nathan," I said to our company pilot. "My dad always told me nothing bad can happen if you carry a heads-up penny." "Well, that cinches it. We're going to have a good flight," Nathan said. I picked up my good luck charm and slid it into the front pocket of my jeans, then climbed on board. Inside the plane was even smaller than I remembered. The cabin was configured so that the four passenger seats faced one another. The cramped space felt claustrophobic, with only a thin curtain separating us from Nathan. I took the seat across from Becky. She was one of my favorite co-workers. You couldn't stay in a bad mood around her. She was like a human antidepressant. I envied that about her. "Good job, everybody," my boss, Tom, said. "Good enough to get tomorrow off?" Becky asked. "No," Tom said, laughing. Like Becky, Tom was always cheerful. You knew he was coming a full minute before he appeared because you would hear him whistling. Sitting across from Tom was his boss, Randy. Randy kept a golden dove pinned to his lapel, a gift from his daughter. I buckled my seatbelt and gazed out the tiny window as the sun drifted lower. The sky was a beautiful shade of coral, the color only God could paint. Glancing at my co-workers, I noticed their eyes already closing. There would be no sleep for me during the flight. I had to stay awake to help fly the plane. I had always been a backseat driver. It drove my husband crazy. I suppose when it came down to it, I got nervous whenever I wasn't in control. The plane taxied down the runway, then came to a stop. That was the worst part for me, the revving of the engines before takeoff. It just didn't make sense that a metal object could fly. We were quiet, barely breathing, as the plane dipped lower. I tried to whisper the Lord's Prayer, but the words stuck in my throat. The engines roared to life, and the plane moved faster and faster until I felt the wheels leave the ground. I wanted to shout, "We made it in the air," but my co-workers were asleep. I wished I could be that trusting. I reached into my pocket and rubbed the penny. Nathan opened the curtain and peeked through. "Can't sleep?" "That's okay. Lots of people are scared to fly." "Sorry," I said. I thought I was better at hiding it. Still, I must have relaxed enough to doze off. Suddenly, I was jerked awake, bouncing in my seat. "Just some turbulence," Nathan said, adjusting his headset. How could my coworkers sleep through all this bumpiness? Outside the window, the once beautiful sky had turned black and threatening. "Are we flying into a storm?" I asked Nathan. "Shouldn't be bad," he said. I wished I could hear what air traffic control was saying to him on the other end. Once again, I felt around for the coin in my pocket. "Come on, Penny, do your stuff." I wondered why I was counting on a superstition to comfort me. Why couldn't I just believe that God had everything under control? The wind jostled the plane back and forth, jarring my co-workers awake. "That's some turbulence, Nathan," Tom said, raising his voice to be heard. "We're getting close. It shouldn't be that much longer," Nathan said. Becky's eyes were shining like saucers in the dim cabin. I guess I wasn't the only one who was scared. Finally, I could see the runway lights. I let out a huge breath, one I hadn't even realized I'd been holding. But then the lights started to disappear. Why were we turning around? We looked at each other, knowing something wasn't right. "Roger that," Nathan said into his headset. Then in a calm voice, he told us, "I didn't hear the landing gear come down. I'm going to fly low so the folks in the tower can shine a light on us to see if they spot it." We were all quiet, barely breathing. As we felt the plane dip lower, everything seemed to be happening in slow motion. We waited for Nathan to tell us the good news, but instead he said, "They didn't see any landing gear. I need you all in the crash position." He closed the curtain. Becky reached across the narrow aisle and grabbed my hand. We bent our heads into our lap, and I heard her crying. I squeezed Becky's fingers and clutched my penny in my other hand. It seemed as if we circled the runway for hours. I lifted my head to try to see what was going on. With each pass, more flashing lights. Fire trucks, ambulances, and police cars lined the runway. Still, the seriousness of the situation didn't really sink in until I saw Tom and Randy shake hands, Randy saying it was great working with you. What? We might die? My heart beat in time with those words. Then, very softly, Randy began saying the Lord's Prayer. He was halfway through when Tom joined him, followed by Becky. I tried to whisper the words, but they stuck in my throat. My co-workers went back to the beginning and kept saying, "Hallowed be thy name." I said, my voice growing stronger, "Thy kingdom come." The plane had stopped circling. We were on our final descent. I gritted my teeth, bracing for the sound of screeching metal, for the sight of a fire crew jumping into action. I felt more than I saw, the penny fly from my hand. "Oh God, no." Then I heard the squeak of wheels against the tarmac, felt the plane rumble down the runway and slow to a stop. Somehow the landing gear had come down. The adrenaline was pumping so hard I started shaking. It was over. We were safe. I looked around the cabin floor for my lucky penny. It was nowhere to be found. Of course, it wasn't the penny that I needed to hold on to when things were beyond my control, but the message inscribed on it, "In God we trust." The joy of gratitude. Grateful in all things. The answer came like a breeze brushing my cheek. By Raylene Nickel, Keefe, North Dakota. Finally, I finished cutting down a thicket of weeds in a paddock that my cows had yet to graze. It had taken 2 hours of hard physical work. I stood still, catching my breath, gripping the wooden handle of my scythe. Taking off my glove, I ran my finger lightly around the curved blade. Its edge was starting to blunt from all the cutting. On the bigger weeds, I'd had to use both hands to swing the scythe sharply like a bat. The tool had once belonged to my husband, John. I adopted it after he died 11 years ago. It cut weeds better than my lighter scythe, and I'd use it so much that its 2-foot handle had cracked. I'd wrapped the length of it with duct tape for support. We'd been through a lot, this scythe and me. My side ached. Swinging the scythe aggravated ribs I'd recently bruised, but it was rewarding to see a clean paddock, free of the tall invasive gray weeds, wormwood, that flowered this time of year in the late summer. All that remained was a thick stand of grass and alfalfa swaying in the breeze, stuff the cows loved to eat. Left to its own devices, the wormwood would have taken over. My satisfaction lasted all of 10 minutes, the time it took me to walk to the adjoining pasture. Another weed, nearly as bad as the wormwood, greeted me. Canada thistle, and it had gone to seed. Its fluffy, cottony heads were on the verge of spreading seeds wherever the wind blew, a nightmare in the making. I couldn't scythe it now. That would only spread the seeds more. All I could do was plan for future control. I'd have to keep an eye out for new shoots in the spring and run the cows in this paddock so they could graze and eat the weeds. I let out a heavy sigh. "Father, how could this happen? I thought you'd help me get the thistle under control." John and I had fought thistle for years. After he died, I experimented with management practices that had subdued the weed without using chemicals. For one thing, I had whacked the thistle with a scythe at its critical growth stages, but it had bested me again. This farm, all the work and planning that went into running it, I needed a break. I climbed into my pickup and drove to the house for coffee. Sitting on the back porch, I took stock. My discouragement came from more than just thistles and wormwood. For weeks, I suffered a kind of grayness in my spirit, feeling joyless, alone, fearful of the future. Every task felt overwhelming. My days passed as if I were on a treadmill, stuck in a wearisome routine. There was no place on earth I would rather live than on this farm, no work I would rather do. I had good friends. I got together with my sister Karen every week. Yet my life, along with my prayers, once so fervent, filled with detail, had grown lackluster. The prairie vista, flowing from my back porch, failed to inspire me. What was wrong with me? Where had the spring in my step gone? I was 71. Was this what aging was about? Had the passing of years finally caused my hope to dissolve? Even in my grief over John's long illness and death, I had hope, energy to drive my goals and to work, to pray. Only weeks before he died, John had sat beside me right here on this porch step. "Do you have a plan?" he asked. "This isn't stopping." He meant his illness, and his tone was urgent. He wondered about the future of the farm. We hadn't talked about plans for the farm or me after his death. We simply lived the days we had together. "My only plan is to pray," I said. "That's cool," John said softly. We never spoke of it again. Upon his death, my world exploded with grief and with the burning realization that I had a farm to run. By our community standards, it was a small farm, 400 acres, but its care required significant effort. We built an uncommon place by honing natural management practices. We created a circle of concert. Building health in the soil was our first priority. Healthy soil grew healthy plants, and these plants produced healthy cattle and goats, which in turn produced healthy food to sustain the health of the people working for the farm. After John's death, I had to modify our systems so that they worked for me. I made mistakes, I failed, but I kept trying and I kept praying. I imagined and implemented solutions to the problems I found. Once I let a neighbor harvest a second cut of alfalfa in one field in the late fall, but the winter was brutally cold and no snow fell to cover the ground with an insulating blanket that would protect the shorn alfalfa from cold. Many plants died. I was devastated. I had to reseed and reseed. I never again permitted a second harvest of alfalfa. I changed our winter feeding system for cattle by putting bales in small enclosures and letting the cattle eat smorgasbord style, one enclosure at a time. I planted a couple hundred more trees. As John and I had done, I kept improving the genetics of the herd by artificially inseminating good cows to top-notch sires. I kept on milking goats. I paid off loans and a land note to bring the farm out of debt. I gave money and cattle to beginning farmers. I did the work of the farm alone, except for the harvesting of hay in the summer, work done by my neighbor Sam and a couple other young farmers. I'd done all of the things that John and I had dreamed of doing, yet here I was, sitting on the back porch, listless and defeated. "Father, help me find my stride for this next stage of life," I asked. "Help me make sense of what I'm feeling." There was no taking a day off. Farm chores couldn't wait. In the days that followed, I cut more wormwood using my tractor and rotary mower. I worked in paddocks where the cows had already grazed so that I wasn't cutting grass along with weeds. The mower made short work of the pesky wormwood, and my rib had time to heal up. As I worked, answers to my prayers began to form, like a breeze brushing my cheek. Instead of dwelling on difficulties, draw joy from your work. Keep looking for the beauty and miracles I have placed in your life. Thank me for these things. I'd once made a habit of this, but it had been a long time since I made gratitude a daily intentional practice. I'd let the demands of the farm take priority. "Okay, Father, I'll try harder to remember your miracles." I tried to see the beauty of the plants, all of them. I even thanked God for the thistle, realizing that it was more abundant this year simply because of nature's cycles. I gave thanks for the hawks soaring in the sky, the brilliant yellow and black goldfinch perched atop a thistle, the record hay crop, Sam's hard work, the strength to swing a scythe, and the ability to pray. When I returned to hand-whacking weeds, the work took me into the middle of a patch of Canada thistle peppered with wormwood. I could hardly endure the discomfort of wading through the waist-high prickly thistle to get at the even taller wormwood. Yet it got me thinking. I could redesign the fencing here to open up the area to Sam's hay machines next summer. The thistle would get cut at a vulnerable stage in its development. After the weeds were shorn, I could plant alfalfa to compete with the weeds and reduce their growth. The idea brought a sense of expectancy that good would come from my work, a twinkling of joy. Next, I tackled a grass strip between two rows of trees, bordered on both sides by verdant fields of alfalfa. I remembered working on that strip years earlier on an invigorating fall day with a cool breeze driving a light drizzle. I'd had so much hope that every swing of my scythe would in time overcome the weeds. That's exactly what happened. Now there were just a few puny weeds I easily whipped off. Stepping back, I gazed up at the towering cottonwood trees. Some of the trees John and I had originally planted had drowned out in a flood, but the cottonwoods sprang up on their own in place of the dead trees. Now they were majestic. Then, near the trees, I spied some lovely wild goldenrod blooming. I picked some to dry and put in a vase to brighten my dining room in winter. The vivid yellow flowers are a reminder that God restores both my joy and my strength. I walked to the next field with my scythe in hand and a bounce in my step. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access at any time, on demand, at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. The crowd cheered in Beaumont, Texas, 16 years ago as a college student with a bright purple mohawk bounded up on the stage. At only 20, he'd been chosen to help chair Relay for Life, an annual fundraiser for the American Cancer Society, an organization he'd volunteered with since he was 12. The charity was $10,000 short of its $110,000 goal that night, with the clock ticking down to the midnight deadline. A committee member shouted, "Hey, how about you shave off your mohawk if we hit our goal?" The young man on stage was into his hair. It was a way to express himself and the causes he cared about. But he didn't hesitate. He shouted back, "Sure, it's only hair." His co-chair, a hairdresser, had clippers in her car and ran out to get them just in case. The crowd counted down as more donations came in. Then bam, the total shot over $110,000 just as the clock struck 12. The co-chair jumped up onto the stage with her clippers, and in minutes, purple hair littered the floor. The young man grinned gingerly, rubbing his bald head. The next day, his mom was touching up some patchy areas when she noticed two dime-sized spots on his scalp. Those spots hadn't been there after his short haircut 6 months earlier. His doctor took samples for biopsy and was worried enough to send slides to be reviewed at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. The diagnosis was frightening. The lesions were melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. Surgeons at MD Anderson excised the melanomas in a crescent-shaped cut, also removing some lymph nodes to check for metastasis. Miraculously, no lymph nodes were involved and tissue margins were clear. The anticipated skin graft proved unnecessary. Because the cancer had been detected early, the young man required no further treatment. He knew it wasn't just luck that he'd been dared to shave his head, allowing the potentially lethal melanoma to be caught in time. "This is a God thing," he thought. He pledged to show his gratitude by living a life helping others and serving the Lord. That college kid with the purple mohawk, that was me. I'm 36 now, still cancer-free after 16 years, and happily working for a nonprofit healthcare organization, giving back to the community that saved my life. Josh Davis, Beaumont, Texas. For more on this story, see Family Room. The Power of Forgiveness, Making Things Right, by Diane Stark, Brazil, Indiana. My dad and I never really connected. Now that doctors told him he just had months to live, would we ever? I had just finished loading the groceries in my trunk that July day when my cell phone rang. The caller ID said John. My heart beat faster. I debated answering before hitting the button to take the call. "Hello, Dad," I said. "Hi, Diane," he said. "I'm calling to let you know that my cancer is back and there's nothing more for the doctors to do. I've got 3 to 6 months." "I'm so sorry to hear that," I said. And I was, though maybe not for the obvious reason. "It's all right. I'm an old man and I've lived a long life. I'm right with God and I'm right with all of my kids. That's all that matters to me. He thought things were right between us. I'd seen him 3 times over the past 25 years and hadn't spoken to him in 4. His choice, all of it. But how could I bring that up now? Instead, I blurted out without even knowing if I meant it, I forgive you for everything that happened. Thanks for that, he said after a beat. Well, I've got other calls to make, so I won't keep you. Wait, I said. I'm a grandma now. Leah had a baby girl. She's 2. Oh, how nice. I'm sure you're enjoying that. Well, I've got other people to call. Jordan is engaged. He's getting married next July. That's great. Tell him congratulations. I should really go now. Desperate, I tried once more. Nathan is entering high school in the fall. He wants to be a pastor when he grows up. You must be very proud of him. You and Eric did a great job with your kids. I'm going to hang up now. It was nice talking to you, Diane. Goodbye. I stared at the phone screen in disbelief. That call had lasted 2 minutes and 14 seconds. I tried to tell myself that he was tired, but the reassurance was hollow. I dialed my husband, Eric. When he answered, I said, "My dad just called to tell me he's dying, and that's not the worst part." Biting back tears, I relayed the conversation. That's probably the last time I'll ever talk to him, and he didn't even pretend to care. He never asked about you or the kids, and when I tried to tell him what was happening in our lives, he blew me off. I kept trying to talk to him like some pathetic little kid begging for her father's attention, and all he wanted to do was hang up so he could call some more important people. Eric tried to console me, but I felt humiliated. Even after all these years, I was still seeking the approval of a man who'd never given it to me. Why did I still care about making our relationship right when he thought it already was? Eric asked if I wanted to go see my dad one last time, but I didn't. If he didn't even want to stay on the phone with me for more than 2 minutes and 14 seconds, why would I drive 3 hours to visit? I debated calling Dad back, but I didn't think I could take any more rejection, not after a lifetime of it. In a group text with my siblings that night, I said he just didn't care. Nobody disagreed. I was the 2nd child of 4 and the oldest daughter. My dad was an engineer who commuted to a large firm in downtown Chicago from our home in Northwest Indiana. He worked long hours and often had meetings in the evening. On Saturdays, he relaxed by working on an old car in the garage. I would sit at the picnic table in the backyard reading a book. I knew that eventually my dad would get thirsty and send me inside to get him a glass of lemonade. I loved the look on his face when I handed him the frosty glass. I'd earned his approval, however briefly, and it felt great. I prayed we would grow closer. On Sundays, we attended church as a family. My dad was a deacon. We read a chapter of the Bible after dinner every night. I went to youth group every Wednesday night, and most of my friends were believers. Religion was a huge part of my upbringing, but I never felt stifled by it. I was grateful. My dad and I had our faith in common, but that was it. Even then, it felt as if we were living parallel lives. Our relationship existed on his terms. If I was willing to read at the picnic table, he'd spare a few minutes from his hobby to talk to me. Eventually, I stopped trying so hard. What was the point? He showed little interest in anything I did. Besides, I'd always been naturally closer to my mom. I was a teenager who was bored with fetching lemonade. At 17, I had my first serious boyfriend. I asked my dad whether he liked the boy. "He's okay," he said. "Pretty fluffy, though." Fluffy? What does that mean? Shallow. He might have an attractive exterior, but there's nothing of substance underneath. I defended my boyfriend fiercely. "You don't know him like I do." My father just shrugged. A few weeks later, my family was traveling in the car. It was late at night, and my parents must have assumed my siblings and I were asleep. "I need to take Diane's prom dress shopping tomorrow," I heard my mom say. "We've been to a few stores, but she hasn't found the right dress yet." My dad sighed. "I wish she'd focus more on her grades and less on dumb things like prom. She's so fluffy sometimes." Fluffy, that word my dad had used to describe shallow people with no substance. He just used that word to describe me. I sat in the dark in the back seat, tears slipping down my cheeks. I was crushed. No wonder he wasn't interested in having a relationship with me. I never told anyone what I heard that night. I was too ashamed. It was a relief to go away to college, yet distance didn't change my heart. If my father answered when I called home, we'd make harmless talk, fluffy, you might say, before he handed off the phone to Mom. The one thing he showed any interest in was whether I'd found a church to attend. It felt to me more like badgering than true concern, like an engineer trying to get that part to fit in its place. But I had no intention of finding a church. At that vulnerable point in my life, I was asking myself, if I can't win my earthly father's unconditional love, what chance do I have of winning God's? Does he think I'm fluffy? I pushed God away, too. I got married right after graduation, had my first baby 2 years later. Then after 30 years together, my father walked out on Mom for another woman. Mom was devastated, and my dad was to blame. It was the end of whatever was left of my relationship with my father. Years went by, Mom remarried, and I heard from my brother that my dad did too. I had another child, and then my own marriage fell apart. After a few years as a single mom, I met Eric. He was a single dad of two, and we married in June of 2007. Just after our first anniversary, we added a fifth child to our family, a boy named Nathan. I felt my life was on track. During my time as a single mom, I'd gone back to church. I still struggled with the idea that God loved me without my having to earn it, that he loved me simply because I was his daughter, but I was working on it. I was growing again in my faith. I saw my dad only a few times over the years. Once Eric and I met him for dinner. Eric is also an engineer. The two of them really hit it off. They talked the whole time. Clearly, Dad recognized Eric as a person of substance. I was glad for Eric. But what about me? I was hurt, again. Will Dad ever love me for the person I am? And now my father was dying, and he never would. I was surprised when Dad called me in October. "Your brother Tim has been nagging me to call you," he said. "He told me that the last time we spoke, I hurt your feelings. So please tell me about your family. I wanted to hear about your life." Did he really, or was he calling just to get my little brother off his back? This wasn't the conversation I wanted to have with my father, where the honesty and forgiveness were real. Apparently, this was all I was going to get. He listened politely while I updated him on my life. For 20 minutes, I shared what Eric and each of our kids had been up to. Then he said, "And what about you? Your brother told me you're a writer now. That's pretty cool." That took me aback. There was approval, even admiration in his voice. I told him I often write about my faith journey. "I'm glad you came back to your faith," he said. "All those years ago, I know you thought I was nagging when I asked if you had found a church. I wasn't trying to nag. I wanted you to stay close to God." That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. We'll finish this article next time. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.